Well, welcome everybody to today's series, a TeleSummit interview with Dr. Ed Shaw, who is he's not only an MD, but he's also the director of the, I'm going to read this bio in a second, the memory counseling program at Wake Forest Baptist Health. So welcome, Dr. Shaw.
Thank you.
Awesome. And today's topic is going to be about Alzheimer's. His lovely wife was afflicted with that disease, and I know so many of our viewers either are living with somebody with the disease or have known somebody with the disease, so I think this just affects so many people, so it's just such a crucial, important topic, so it really is a great honor to have you with us today.
Thanks, Tina.
Let me circle back and actually read this bio, and then we will get into a few questions I've got for you. So Dr. Edward Shaw is duly trained as a physician and mental health counselor. He was primary care partner for his wife, Rebecca, who developed Alzheimer's disease at age 53 and died in 2016 after a 9-year battle. Inspired by Rebecca's journey, Dr. Shaw founded the Memory Counseling Program at Wake Forest Baptist Health in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. The program provides counseling support for individuals diagnosed with Alzheimer's and other dementias, as well as their primary care partner and other family caregivers, including support groups. He is also co-author of the book, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The 5 Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey. And I have read that book, and it is beautiful. It's beautiful. It's a must-read, I would think, for everybody. I mean, really, not whether you've had Alzheimer's in your life or not, it's just lovely. So thank you for gifting that to the world.
Sure.
Because it's beautiful. So what I'd like to do is get right into some questions I've got for you, and let our viewers experience all your wonderful advice and experience. So your wife, Rebecca, did Rebecca and you and your family respond to her diagnosis of Alzheimer's at the age of 53? Isn't that really young to get that disease?
It is young. Of people who develop Alzheimer's disease, about 1 in 20 are 65 or under. And that's called early onset Alzheimer's. And so, yes, she was young to develop the disease. And actually, I'm getting a lot of feedback. I'm trying to figure.
Maybe lower your speakers a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, sorry.
That's fine.
Let me figure out how to do that here.
Good.
Just got a new laptop. My other laptop died. Okay. Let me do this. Okay, so I'm turning my speakers off on my computer. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Oh, but I can't hear you.
Oh, you can't hear me.
So that's not going to work.
Now, I'm not getting feedback on this end, if that makes you feel any better.
Okay. I adjusted the speaker volume down.
That helps.
Okay. Sorry about that.
You're good.
That's better.
You're good. So we're talking about Rebecca's reaction to the diagnosis as well as you and your family.
Yeah. So as I was mentioning, about 1 in 20 people develop early onset Alzheimer's disease, which is the onset of the disease at age 65 or younger. So the vast majority of people who have Alzheimer's are older. The average age of diagnosis is probably 75 or 80. Mm-hmm. So we were, as a family, quite shocked when she had that diagnosis. I think being a physician, I was suspecting that that's what was going on, because Rebecca was a very bright person. She had a master's degree in speech pathology, kind of very capably ran a household of one husband and 3 children. And we began seeing things that we knew were different for her. Memory loss, difficulty understanding what we were saying to her, difficulty retaining information, new information. And we always marveled at her ability to navigate around. We called her the human compass. And she began getting lost in Winston-Salem, where we had lived for many years. So there were just a lot of signs. And I think in a way, I wasn't surprised, although we all hoped that wasn't wasn't going to be the diagnosis. So I think we were all pretty much in shock, including her, when we heard the Alzheimer's diagnosis, in part because she was so young. And also, it's an incurable disease. It's still an incurable disease. Mm-hmm. And so you just kind of see a whole future that you had planned unfold in front of you because, you know, the average life expectancy is 8 to 10 years. In fact, she lived 9 years, oh, wow. Sort of right in the ballpark of what you expect for this this terrible disease. And so for my daughters, who are 19, 21, and 23, the time she was diagnosed, even a bigger impact because, you know, they wanted mom to see them get married and have children, and, you know, that future kind of dissipates too. Mm-hmm. So we were pretty much in shock and I think surprised that while we were able to get a diagnosis and we had her evaluated at Wake Forest, we had her seen by a physician from Duke and at Mayo Clinic, you know, great diagnosis options, but not much in the way of family caregiver support. So here we began our journey as her primary care partners or caregivers, and there was no emotional support for the journey. Right. And I think that's what prompted my career change in writing the book.
Right. And let me back up just a minute. So from when you first started noticing signs and symptoms, from how long was it from the beginning of, that doesn't seem quite right, to the diagnosis?
Well, I remember specifically in 2007, in the spring of 2007, she and I were sitting at the kitchen table. She was reading U.S. News and World Report, the print edition of, I don't think that magazine is still around. But I remember she remarked to me, you know, I've read this article over and over 3 times, and I can't remember a single thing from it.
Oh my goodness.
That was really the first time that my ears kind of perked up, I think, and the diagnosis was made that summer.
Okay.
So I think in retrospect, looking back, there may have been some symptoms there, even going back to 2005. That's when our oldest daughter, Erin, got married, and Rebecca helped Erin plan the wedding. And in retrospect, Erin said, you know, mom was not quite as focused or organized as I remember her being. Huh. And then maybe some really subtle short-term memory kinds of things in between 2005 and 2007. But honestly, that was the event in the spring of 2007 that grabbed our attention.
Reading and, the article, she couldn't.
Yeah, because she couldn't remember or learn new information. And so,
because I think everybody has some moments when, you know, where are the keys and that kind of thing. And, you know, when we may get into this with some of the other questions, but you just, you know, you don't know what's just normal. Oh, well, you know, that's just being forgetful, or that might be something to look into.
Right.
You also said something that, typical life expectancy is 8 to 9 years. Is it less on average the younger the diagnosis? Seems like I've heard that somewhere. Is that true or not?
It is true. Younger people who develop dementia, and there's a couple different kinds that are more common in younger people. So one of them is the early onset Alzheimer's. The other is another type of dementia more characterized by changes in behavior, and that's called frontotemporal dementia. And the early onset Alzheimer's and the frontotemporal dementias, they have an average life expectancy of about 5 to 7 years. So Rebecca did live longer than expected, and I think it was in part because of the care that she had.
Right. So let me just see. You have had pretty much two different careers as a physician. So what compelled your career change from doctor to mental health counselor? And share with the viewers the type of physician you were before you got into counseling.
Sure. So prior to Rebecca's diagnosis, I was a brain tumor doctor. And came to Wake Forest in 1995 as department chairman of radiation oncology. So that was my particular specialty in brain tumor treatment, was radiation. And I was one of the assistant directors of the Comprehensive Cancer Center there.
Okay.
And so my life's work had been treating adults and children who had primary brain tumors. And my research area had always been in cognitive function in cancer patients. So memory and thinking function in cancer patients who either had a brain tumor, which can directly affect cognitive function, or had treatments like chemotherapy. For instance, women with breast cancer who had chemotherapy, and there's a known cognitive impairment that can occur there. My life's work was really dedicated to people who had the kind of symptoms that Rebecca had. It's just, it was more related to their cancer situation. And in fact, by 2007, and I say this in a spirit of humility, but I'd really become kind of an international expert on the diagnosis and radiation treatment of people with brain tumors. So when her symptoms occurred, I was really at the height of my professional career. But then when she received the diagnosis, you know, she and I met when we were 19, our sophomore year of college, and we had been together from 1980 through 2007. So 27 years at that point. And, we had those marriage vows that were very important. And I knew that I couldn't continue my career and be her primary caregiver and, you know, be her husband at the same time. So I made the decision to step down from my administrative responsibilities as department head and assistant cancer center director. And I did continue to practice through 2010, just part-time, but really decided, and I think this is more like a calling, this is more of a spiritual phenomenon than it is maybe a logical career change. But I felt this real calling to help others who are on the same journey that the girls and I were with Rebecca. And so I decided to get a master's degree in mental health counseling. And I went to school part-time while I worked part-time and then took care of her. And then I stepped away from my work as a doctor full-time several years later and started the counseling center at Wake Forest for families like us, families who had a newly diagnosed loved one with Alzheimer's or another dementia, who then were on the same journey. And since we opened that counseling center in fall of 2011, we've helped hundreds and hundreds of families. And the disease, unfortunately, is just as incurable now as it was in 2007. And in some ways, I think partnering with families is as important as the medical treatment, because it is incurable.
Exactly. And I was lucky enough to hear you speak last fall, which was really only a couple of months after Rebecca had died. And I really want everybody to read this book, Keeping Love Alive, as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages, and The Alzheimer's Journey, because you guys really did have a beautiful love story. And it was an honor to hear you give that first talk about Rebecca's journey shortly after she had died. So I was just very honored to be in the audience and hear that emotional presentation. It was really beautiful. So let me just move on, because I'm really excited for people to hear more about the book. So what are the central messages of the book, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages, and The Alzheimer's Journey? It's really an amazing way this book came to be.
Well, the book is ostensibly about the emotional journey of being an Alzheimer's care partner or caregiver. And I think it's a book that gives hope that you can, in fact, continue to love somebody who has this disease, even though their cognitive function, you know, their very thinking abilities are changing, they're declining as they continue on in the journey. And one of the things that that the girls and I recognize with Rebecca, and I've seen in so many people who have this disease, that while their ability to express love diminishes over time, because one of the features of most of the dementias is that you lose the ability to communicate with language. Especially a challenge for Rebecca, who is a speech teacher. She was a speech pathologist.
Wow.
And her language skills were affected early on. So even though she wasn't able to express her love to the girls and I, we were able to love her, and she was able to receive love really all the way through the end of her journey. And that's true of most people with Alzheimer's disease, that they can feel emotional love even though they're troubled in expecting it all the way to the end of their journey. That's the message of hope for the book.
Yeah, that is so important for the caregivers to know. So describe how, first of all, describe what is the five love languages and how did that become incorporated into your work?
Sure. So The Five Love Languages is a book that was written 25 years ago by Dr. Gary Chapman. And Gary is a pastor and a marriage counselor here in Winston-Salem at Calvary Church. And he had observed in years and years of counseling, literally thousands of couples, that people in a relationship communicate love to each other in one of five languages. So the love languages are metaphorical. But in the same way that if you spoke, say, Chinese and I spoke English, if we didn't know each other's language, we wouldn't be able to understand what we're communicating. And he uses that same sort of metaphor image for the love languages of when people communicate emotional love to one another. So those love languages are things like quality time, physical touch, acts of service, gifts, tangible gifts. So it's terrible. I'm blocking on the fifth. I have a mental block now. But these are different ways that people can communicate their love to one another. And the idea with the love languages is that you speak the love language of your partner. So, for instance, my primary love language is physical touch. I like to hug. Rebecca's primary love language was acts of service. So when I came home from a busy day at work, I would always give her a hug. Maybe that was more for me. What really spoke to her was an act of service, say taking the kids and letting her grab a glass of wine and chill out for an hour because she had had a busy day with the kids. And that was an act of service to her. And so, the other love language is words of affirmation.
Right.
So the very simple message of his book was you can use these five love languages to help your partner feel loved. So if your partner's love language, let's say, is words of affirmation, and you bring flowers every day, that's not going to be speaking their primary love language. So for the book, and really for what we observed in Rebecca's journey in our home, both for the girls and I, our other family members, our friends, the paid caregivers we had to care for her, that we could use the five love languages as simple tools to help remind us that we could communicate love to Rebecca in different ways. And as people fail cognitively, their primary love language becomes less relevant to them. They need to have love spoken to them in many different ways.
Ah.
So just as a simple example, Rebecca and I, after as she progressed in her disease, and she did come to a point where she didn't know me or the girls as her husband and her daughters anymore. Very painful part of the journey. But we wanted to continue loving her, and we wanted her to know she was loved. But sometimes in the evening after supper, I would sit down with her, and she had some visual impairment, so I would have a DVD player. She loved music. And she particularly loved the movie The Sound of Music.
Oh.
And so if you buy the DVD now, you can just listen to the soundtrack of the movie. They just play through the songs. She loved to hear that soundtrack. It was about 1 hour. And that was a time when I could sit next to her. I could physically touch her.
Which tells you that's your love language.
That's my love language. And I could tell her that I loved her, words of affirmation. Really an act of service was just playing that DVD for her. Right. So I bet you that DVD was played 1,000 times in the last years of her journey. Right. I could tell you every word of every song in The Sound of Music, but it was really, it was all about for her.
Sure.
And the I love yous, you know, were words of affirmation. And then one of the things she loved was ice cream cones. That was her gift.
Hear that story.
It was in the book, yes. And so bringing her an ice cream cone or having one of the caregivers bring her an ice cream cone, that was a wonderful gift to her. And so these were ways that we could use the five love languages to communicate love to her. And it's a very simple framework. And through the book, we give examples of how to love somebody with the five love languages at the early stage, the middle stage, and the late stage of the disease.
And did you say that the primary love language, so hers was acts of service, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Did you say that always remained her primary, but then there would be others that would speak to her on a certain day more effectively than maybe what her primary love language was?
Well, I think as cognitive function fails, the primary love language becomes less prominent and all of the love languages become meaningful. Although I will say that one of the things Rebecca loved to do was wash dishes. She wasn't big on dishwasher. She didn't grow up with one. And she used to love washing dishes by hand. And this was true all through our married life together. When we had friends over, she would always wash dishes by hand with usually the wife and the couple that we were socializing with. And it was very interesting until just a few months before she died, she always wanted to wash dishes after a meal. She would pick up her plate and she would take it into the kitchen. She couldn't wash dishes very well at the end. She didn't get the plate clean. You know, she would partially clean it. She would dry it and she would put it back on the, you know, in the cabinet. And it didn't really matter, but that act of service kind of persisted for her. And one of the things we talk about in the book is that when you know your loved ones with dementia, their primary love language, you can facilitate that love language late into the disease. So we would help her to wash dishes even late into the disease.
Right. And then you speak in the book about how to figure out what your love language is.
Mm-hmm.
So can you speak about that?
Sure. So with Dr. Chapman's book, there's a number of five love language inventories. And they're available for free on the website, fivelovelanguages.com. And it's a 30-question questionnaire. And you go through those questions, and then you can, in 5 or 10 minutes, you can figure out for yourself what your primary love language or love languages are. And there's five love language inventories for couples, for singles, even for teens and children.
Oh my gosh.
And so we give examples. We give the inventories in the second chapter of the book. But sometimes if the person is late in their disease, they really are not able to understand the questions or either verbally or in writing. And so then you have to put your detective hat on and figure out through observing things that they love or things that they don't love so much and try and sort of back into their primary love language. But as I mentioned, it's really the five love languages are more of a toolkit. And so as the person progresses in their disease, you really think about all five love languages and how you can show your love for that person using any and all of them.
Okay, great. Yeah, right. Any and all of them. So what's wonderful is as soon as people finish listening to this interview, they can go to 5lovelanguages.com, get that questionnaire, complete it, and have your loved ones complete it as well. And especially if you're dealing with somebody with Alzheimer's, you can kind of start incorporating just being mindful of that. But definitely, definitely get this book, because there's so many great suggestions and examples and tools in that book that would be so valuable to them. And then people that don't have an Alzheimer's situation, I mean, if you've got a special person in your life, it might just help your relationship, you know,
yes,
to begin with.
Yes.
So let's see. So what advice would you give to someone who is caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's disease? And I also wanted to, if you can speak to dementia versus Alzheimer's, because I think some people don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Speak. Yep. So I think a really common term that we use as Americans is dementia and Alzheimer's. That's technically, it's not correct. The word dementia refers to a set of symptoms like memory loss, difficulty with language, with multitasking, maybe some spatial issues. These are all symptoms of cognitive problems that are characteristic of people who have dementia. But dementia in and of itself isn't a diagnosis. It's just a cluster of symptoms. The most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease or Alzheimer's dementia. About 70% of people who have dementia have Alzheimer's disease. Another 10, 15, maybe 20% have what's called vascular dementia. So after a stroke, they develop cognitive troubles and then progressive symptoms of cognitive disability. So that's the second most common vascular dementia. And then there's several others, frontotemporal dementia, which I mentioned earlier, Parkinson's disease related dementia, something called Lewy body dementia, and these make up the majority of other forms of dementia. And then there's many rare, very rare causes of dementia. So really Alzheimer's and dementia is technically not a correct term. It would be dementia of the Alzheimer's type or dementia of the frontotemporal type. And so the book, The Five Love Languages, what really talks about or addresses the emotional journey that people have as they are a caregiver. And we use the term care partner and caregiver. So when somebody's early in the disease, their only symptom may be memory loss. Mm-hmm. So the idea of somebody saying, well, you need a caregiver could be offensive to them.
Right.
Say, well, I'm fine. I just have trouble remembering things. So earlier in the journey, we encourage the use of the word care partner. Okay. Is that really, because you really are partnering together.
Right.
I think the message that I would say for care partners or caregivers is that being a care partner, a caregiver, can't be a solo journey. Has to be a team sport.
Right.
That this is a very emotionally draining experience. And I've said in interviews before, you can be the most emotionally strong person, the most physically strong person, the most spiritually strong person, but at some point as a caregiver, a care partner, the disease, the journey as a caregiver will break you. And you have to have other people there to hold you up, you know, to nourish your own soul, so that you have the energy to be with that person you love through the years of their disease. You know, Rebecca lived 9 years. That's about 10,000 days. That's lots of caregiving days. You know, of course, it's worse for her. She has the disease, but it's very hard for the care partner, for the caregiver, and you have to have family members and friends who are going to help you in the journey. I don't know how many family members I've had come to me since reading the book and saying, I had no idea that my sister or my brother or my mom or my dad was going through the extent of emotional burden that they were going through.
So what are some examples of how family and friends can help you? Or would you even, as the caregiver, would you recommend that they asked for help? And if so, what kind? What, so a few yes. examples.
So I think asking the person is probably the most helpful. You know, many of us, we want to we want to do it on our own. This is really true of people who would be like my parents' age, you know, in their 80s or 90s. That generation really was all about, you know, the husband taking care of the wife and the wife taking care of the husband and, you know, very traditional marriage roles. And so often the tendency is for caregivers to want to do this journey on their own. But I think it's most important, most helpful to just ask them, what can I do for you? You know, but sometimes people will say, well, I'm just overwhelmed. I don't know what you can do for me. So then you try and figure out maybe what is my sister or brothers or parents, what is their love, primary love language? And so if it's, say, words of affirmation, find a time to have coffee for them, with them, or watch the loved one while they go have coffee with a close family member or friend. You know, mow the lawn, come clean the kitchen, you know, just come and do things for them that you know are things they might not be doing for themselves. And just helping to fill their, the metaphor Gary uses in his book is the emotional love tank. You know, the caregiving is emotionally draining, and you can do things, depending on what their own love languages are, to really fill their emotional love tank.
Right. I know I've actually heard that analogy before, and I think it's wonderful because I've heard people say, if you're in a relationship and there's not, this person isn't really giving you what you need, your tank goes dry, which makes you completely exhausted, as opposed to a very strong relationship where they're constantly filling each other's tank, which keeps their energy up, their love up, their relationship rich. And so I think that's just a great analogy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because the car can't go if the tank's empty.
Right, right. I think it's, your comment reminds me of one of the hardest things I tell care partners or caregivers when I'm counseling them is that the relationship, the emotional aspects of the relationship are no longer reciprocal.
Right.
That the burden of carrying the relationship falls more on the care partner. And that's hard. You know, that makes that hole in the gas tank, sometimes it's gaping, you know, and the farther along in the disease the loved one is, the bigger that hole is, and the faster their love tank drains as the care partner, the caregiver. So people have to be really intentional about holding somebody up who's a caregiver.
I would think it's also extremely hard when the symptoms involve violence, when they become very agitated, and you're wanting to show them love because, as you said, they can still sense and feel love shown to mm-hmm. them. And that's got to be really hard when the person with the disease is being mean to you.
Yes. Yes. And so you're right. That's aggressive or anger behavior does occur for many people who have Alzheimer's disease. It's even more characteristic of some of the other types of dementia. And so, yes, it's hard when your loved one is screaming at you or hitting you. It's hard to love them.
Right.
We talk about that in the book that about some of the causes of those, we call them challenging behaviors, negative behaviors. And really what's at the core of that agitated or aggressive behavior is that the loved one is feeling unattached to their primary, their peeps. You know, if at the point where Rebecca didn't know the girls in me, I mean, we were the central figures in her life. We were her main love attachments. And to really not know who that guy is that lives in my house or is wanting to get in the bed with me, that would make any of us afraid and fearful.
Right.
So we do talk quite a bit in the book about how to approach people who have these challenging behaviors in a loving way.
Yeah, it's an extremely powerful and instructional book with just so many wonderful suggestions. before, I want to be respectful of the time, so we're going to need to wrap up, but I just want to ask this last question. The United States is facing an epidemic of Alzheimer's disease. Why is that, and what does that mean?
Right now in the United States, about 5.5 million people have the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. Another 2 million people have the other forms of dementia I referred to. Because of all of us aging baby boomers, in about another 25 years or so, the incidence of Alzheimer's disease is going to triple to approaching 16 million. We had 11 caregivers for Rebecca. Let's say on average a family has three caregivers. That means the number of caregivers now is 15 million or more. In 25 years, it'll be 45 million or more. And this is literally an epidemic. There's no other disease that's going to affect us in proportions like that than Alzheimer's disease. Oh my God. And
what
we're going to be.
How do we face that onslaught?
Yeah, so we have to prepare, you know, the next generation of healthcare workers, physicians, paid caregivers, nurses, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, people who are going to take care of us who have the disease, and the elderly, as well as all the services that revolve around that. And right now, I think in the healthcare budget, some $220 billion is spent on Alzheimer's care. Just, you know, do the math, triple that, and that's going to approach, $500 billion or more. And Tina, we're not ready for it, not from a manpower standpoint or from a financial impact standpoint.
Right. So, and I know we've gone a little long, but I really want you to share with the group your counseling program. You've got one-on-one and groups, and speak just briefly about the miracle of music with Alzheimer's patients.
Sure. So music I'll start there because music is so wonderful. It was such a big part of Rebecca's journey. Music is a form of words of affirmation, but because most of us start listening to music as young children, and we all have wonderful memories attached to songs we heard, whether they're the nursery rhymes when we were single digits or, you know, the songs of our teenage years that we love, there's a lot of strong emotional memories linked with music. And there have been some researchers in the field who have made the wonderful discovery that music can literally make a person sort of come alive again who's quite cognitively impaired. May even be that person you envision in a nursing home, kind of sitting there with their head down to their chest and, you know, not much there. The wonderful YouTube video called Henry Alive Inside, and it has millions of hits, and listeners can go to YouTube and watch that, and it's really a wonderful example of music. And so that's one of the tools we use in our counseling center. So the memory counseling program at Wake Forest Baptist Health is part of geriatrics. And for every person who's newly diagnosed at our medical center with dementia, they get a referral to our program. And we evaluate the person with the dementia and their family caregivers. And we decide who needs the partnership on the journey. And we provide individual counseling for a couple or for a family. And then that's kind of half of what we do. And we have four counselors. We've grown from just, you know, me part of a day to now four of us doing the work. And then the other half of what we do are support groups. We have support groups for caregivers. We have support groups for couples where one person is very early in the journey with their disease. We just finished support group this summer for caregivers with whose loved ones have frontotemporal dementia. And we had a woman in there whose 31-year-old son had a rare form of has a rare form of frontotemporal dementia. So the support groups provide some community. Like I said, this is, you can't go through this alone. And the groups provide a community of other caregivers, care partners who become instant peer group. And we started doing groups 6 years ago. There are people from our original group who are still together. And then for people who have been through, most of our groups initially are 8 weeks, and they provide a core curriculum of education. And then we continue monthly maintenance groups, so people have somewhere to come every month and decompress about their experience and problem solve.
Well, for the viewers, we're going to supply the link to your website that gives the Wake Forest Baptist Health Memory Counseling Program, so they can read about it and see all the various ways to connect with you and your work. But definitely, definitely get the book, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey. It is a must read for anybody that has known anybody with Alzheimer's. It's really wonderful. So Dr. Ed Shaw, thank you so much. This was an honor, and my heartfelt sympathies to you for losing your beautiful wife. I know you guys had just a very amazing love story from, like you say, when you were in your late teens, and she was lucky to have you and your daughters to take such great care of her. And thank you for all the probably thousands by now families and people that you're helping through your work. It's really wonderful.
Thanks, Tina.
This has been an honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.